Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Did you know that the thin-walled produce you eat can be some of the most concerning foods in your diet? That does seem a bit counterintuitive. How can vegetables and fruits possibly be worse than processed food or high fructose corn syrup or feedlot beef? Well, that may come down to the eye of the beholder when this comes into play. A few years ago, we ran some tests here in the States on conventional celery and found trace elements of nearly 70 different chemicals. There were 15 neurotoxins, over a dozen hormone disruptors found on these thin walls of celery. Every year here in the States, we've got a group called the Environmental Working Group, the EWG, who put out an annual list called the Dirty Dozen. And what they focus on is pesticides. And these dirty dozens are the produce products, produce and veg and fruit, that retain the most residue of these pesticides. And the list includes strawberries, grapes, apples, pit fruits, spinach, celery, tomatoes, potatoes, and peppers. Things you think of that would make sense where the thin wall or the skin is actually being what the pesticide is applied to and then you consume. You know, they also include on those same infographics something that they call the Clean 15. And the difference you see in those kiwis and melons and cantaloupes and eggplants, which are safer to consume in a conventional, have less pesticide residue on them, are really around the fact that they have a banana skin, a shell, something that surrounds the exterior that actually receives the application of these synthetic chemicals and can be pulled off. So that puts us in a spot why we have to start looking at these dirty dozens in a different way. And what I want to do here is I'll play devil's advocate and say, with the dosage of application that we're talking about here, and what everything is based off of is the idea of trace elements of these persistent pesticides, is how can we be sure, or can we be sure, that that's safe for us? You know, these neurotoxins and endocrine disruptors have on-field spill factors that can be upset, some estimates put it to 100 times the proper application. And that leads to more than what would be trace elements on these products. And after all, these chemicals are applied to scramble the brains or prevent reproduction of complex pests and often more than just bugs. So we know these chemicals are engineered to last long. And we also know that we found these trace elements of these chemicals, like herbicides of glyphosate, which is Roundup, throughout areas of both poles. So they are lasting. They are there. And we're perpetually getting them in the food that we consume and in the water that we drink. So with skyrocketing rates of neurological issues with our young and our old, that can this be tied to our fruit and veg? Can it be tied to that groundwater runoff? And as a dad of a daughter and a son, do we look at these hormone disruptors as being something that's changing their development? So fundamentally, the objective of nature is the succession plan of our own. And if we're compromising the potential of our kids' health because we're saving 20 cents on a banana, and we're not looking holistically of the impact of these synthetic and persistent pesticides and herbicides and fungicides are having on us and the planet, on our soils, I think we need a whole new awareness campaign associated to this. So as we look at this and say, what does this mean for you and in the planet, the soils, the health of your kids and all? What we're going to do today is we're bringing in a guest, one of the most knowledgeable guests I know in the space, that's been directly involved in addressing many of these issues. Before I jump into that, I want to play a little rhetorical riddle for our audience here. And I'm going to say, what do Prince Charles, Julia Roberts, the King of the Netherlands, Dalai Lama, Bishop Desmond Tutu, activist Vandana Shiva, conservationists and North Face founder Douglas Tompkins all have in common? Well, they have all supported our guest today in his efforts in preserving soil and promoting safe and clean food. So for keeping much of Europe healthier, investing in global soils, and presenting a new look of true cost of cheap food, our guest is a force of nature and more. How's that, Volkert? How do you like that?
That's way too much honor.
Our guest today is Volkert Ingelsmann, who is the CEO of Eosta, the founder of Nature and More, and the creator of Save Our Soils campaign. Volkert, thank you very much for joining us today.
Pleasure, Aaron. Very nice to be with you.
Well, hey, and I apologize, and I say this often, I apologize for my long lead-ups. I get a little verbose, but I get
interesting. Very well summarized.
Well, thanks. I get excited when we have guests of your caliber on the show, because we've known each other for a few years, and I had a chance to do some research prior to us meeting back in 2015 and then ongoing. And I'm always impressed by, you know, not just the actions you're taking, but when you talk to an expert in the space, they really have the ability to take very complex subjects and make it so that everyone understands. And I think that's something you do extremely, extremely well, and probably why you've been empowered to become a trustee of global soils, someone that really is out there fighting the battles and really working with organizations like the UN in trying to establish awareness and understanding of what's going on with our soils. What are the effects of these persistent pesticides, fungicides, and herbicides? So maybe you could start by telling us a little, or our audience a little bit, about your background and what you're doing with Eosta.
Thank you very much for asking, Aaron. About my background, I went to a Steiner school in Germany. Then I studied business administration in Rotterdam and joined Cargill in the United States for a few years. And at some point, I ran into many growers who decided, actually, I want to do this more sustainably, but there doesn't seem to be a market for my product. So we then decided with a couple of friends to start Eosta and to develop that market. And today we're Europe's market leader in organic produce, buying and supporting and developing organic growers around the world and providing them with a market.
And when we met, we had a chance to meet your offices kind of on the east side of the Netherlands, and it was funny because we were chatting, and it was a bit like when you get a couple of Avenger fans that would be at a Comic-Con talking about, you know, their area of interest. We were talking about soil and food and health and the power of business to engage consumers in these broader solutions. And I think that's a unique segue to explain a bit here for our consumers of in Europe, you have slightly different standards of what we say organic, and you use biological or biologic. What are the differences that we should know about that the Europeans have adopted for organic and biologic versus what we have here in the States?
I'm not so sure, Aaron. I think the 95% is similar, and what counts is this growing awareness amongst consumers that organic is not too expensive, but conventional produce too cheap, as long as a whole series of costs are externalized to future generations, or at best to today's taxpayer. Costs of health, costs of pollution of the environment, social injustice. Consumers are increasingly aware, not just as a citizen, that with their wallet, they can contribute to their own health and to the health of their kids. And it's fascinating. I admired what you just said about these pesticides. A lot of these pesticides are, in the meantime, they are systemic pesticides. So even if you peel the fruit, the pesticides will still be inside that fruit. So they will affect you. And this is a growing concern for an increasing number of consumers, and that explains the tremendous growth in demand for organic products.
And organic is a systems discussion here. We're really looking at it from the fundamental, from the propagation, the creation of of the fruits and vegetable all the way through the supply chain and then upon deliverable. And I think a key thing to bring up here is an initiative you've been working on for the last couple of years, is, as you mentioned, is looking at what conventional production has for externalities and the externalized costs associated to that that aren't necessarily put on the bottom line of everything that the consumer is buying at the grocery store. And you've,
right.
you've created a unique approach to this called True Cost Reporting or True Cost Accounting, where it's a program that you released and presented to the likes of the UN and Prince Charles. From my understanding, it's a report that makes clear that organic food is not too expensive, but rather conventional food is too cheap. Could you
right.
provide some more details on that?
Yeah, let's roll back a little bit, Aaron.
Sure.
And before we talk about true cost accounting and monetization of the impact on society and on human health, what I learned from Cargill is that if you commodify products, then you actually anonymize the origin as well. And that means that the consumer has no idea how that product was grown and with what impact. So the first thing we decided when we started AOSTA was to make sure that we make things totally transparent, because our slogan is there's no such thing as sustainability without transparency. So the first thing we started doing is enabling consumers to make an informed purchase decision by measuring the impact on people and planet of our entire supply chain. Then the second M moves in, because if you monitor and measure the impact, you also have a tool to manage. You have a cockpit to manage incremental steps of development on soil fertility, biodiversity, climate change, pollution of the groundwater, and all of that. That brought us to this third M, which is marketing. Because normally we talk a lot about sustainability. Retailers demand all sorts of things from growers, but usually the burden to become more sustainable is shifted towards the primary producer without giving him more money to actually look after healthy soils and clean groundwater and no climate change. So we decided that's why we need a third M, and we need to make these things not just more transparent, but we also need to enable the consumer to pay a premium for all these effects on people and planet that the primary producer can contribute to. If we don't, you know, as one farmer once said to me, how can I become more green if my figures are red? And I think that summarizes it quite nicely, because we fail to do that. And that's where the fourth M of monetization comes in. So which is honestly not really our achievement. It is the achievement of various think tanks based in, the FAO of United Nations, or the United Nations Environmental Program, United Nations Development Program, and there's another think tank called TEEB. I'm sure you're familiar with that, the Economy of Ecosystems and Biodiversity, a coalition of powerful researchers who decided if we want to be serious about a more sustainable planet, then we have to monetize the impact. Because at this moment, we're losing 30 soccer fields of fertile soil per minute, accumulating to 12 million hectares. According to the FAO, 12 million hectares per year as a result of intensive farming. So we pump enormous amounts of nitrogen fertilizers into the soil that have a yield boosting effect at the expense of long-term soil fertility. So if we for some reason, our economy seems to be a little autistic. We count we measure the short-term profit, but we fail to see the bigger picture, and our economy fails to see the bigger horizon. Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, called it literally the pollution of our horizons, a double meaning, a pollution in terms of environmental pollution, but also a pollution in terms of vision. We seem to, so what is happening right now is that sustainability seems to be moving out of its green bubble and descending into the DNA of our markets and our economies. And we seem to be reaching that point where we can address the perverse incentives that are triggered by a short-term profit definition that needs to be revisited. So we need to include costs of soil pollution or soil degradation, soil depletion. We need to address clean water. Just to give you an example, the French government just published a report. I mean, the government, not some sort of activist, green activist group, but the French government discovered that they have a cost of 54 billion euros triggered and caused by groundwater pollution as a result of agrochemicals and nitrogen fertilizers. So that's a strange reality, that in Europe we're supporting an agricultural system with tax money that causes at the same time new costs for the same taxpayer. So who's going to pay for this? And that these think tanks, United Nations, mostly United Nations based think tanks, decided, okay, if we accumulate all these so-called externalized costs, we come to $2.8 trillion per year of environmental costs and $2.1 trillion US dollars social damage, social costs, which is about the equivalent of the total revenues and food products around the world. So a quick calculation shows that food should be actually would have to be twice as expensive if we want to avoid all these externalized costs for future generations. So what we did in that fourth M, Aaron, we said measuring, managing, marketing, but in order to address that perverse incentive that is anchored in that short-term profit definition, we decided, okay, we need to make new profit and loss accounts, new balance sheets, by factoring these, by calculating these externalized costs into our products. So that's what we did. So we teamed up with these think tanks, asked EY, the financial auditor, Ernst & Young, to validate the calculations. And then we created this pilot called True Cost Accounting for Food, Farming, and Finance, in which we addressed the externalized costs for each of our products, each of our growers, on a per hectare basis, for all our consumers on a per kilo basis, and we started publishing these costs at point of sale. And we accumulated these figures in a new profit and loss account to also communicate to the stakeholders and shareholders, and particularly to the financial sector, providing them with a dashboard to address these externalized costs. Yeah, that's what we did.
I think it's absolutely genius. It puts it into context that people can understand. It gives them actionable items to work upon. And I think what many people don't realize that have been obviously not grown up in the space is that, you know, this is just a ripple effect. And Longhorn, how could we get to a point that we are polluting our horizons? And it's more of we've been, especially in our island, which is less populated than your island, we've been able to have this abundance of natural resources where we haven't had to think twice about taking those short horizon returns and not looking at that. But now at 7 billion people, to be 9 billion by 2050, I know that this has become common vernacular around the world to start looking at these things differently and using financial vehicles, using the impetus of the consumer to be that engagement point, I think is absolutely the way forward. And that is a great unifier no matter what economy we're talking about. And, yeah. and go ahead, Volker.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to add, Aaron, that if you look at BlackRock, I think it's the biggest institutional investor on the planet. They start adding not just financial KPIs, but also environmental and social KPIs to estimate the ability of the companies they invest in to make a profit, not just now, but also in the future. Because so what you see is that the financial sector may, whether they do it for moral or ethical reasons, I doubt it, but they move into this very subject for risk mitigation and risk management reasons. So I'm sure you're familiar with the carbon bubble, that if we want to meet the Paris Climate Accord target of 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius global warming increase maximum, then we can only allow ourselves to emit another 500 gigatons of CO2 equivalent greenhouse gases. Yet, all these oil companies, they still have for 2,500 gigatons of CO2 greenhouse gas equivalent fossil fuel reserves in the soil and activated on the balance sheets. So then the financial sector obviously concludes, well, maybe we're probably talking about stranded assets here, because you can dig that stuff up, but you can't sell it. You can't commercialize it, because then we would blast through this 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius ceiling. So that's one thing, which was also addressed by Mark Carney when he talked about the pollution of horizons. The other example is that Standard & Poor's, this credit rating organization, just bought Trucost, which is a London-based think tank that does these true cost accounting exercises. And I don't think they do this for hobby reasons. I think they do this to analyze the risk, to assess the risks of corporations, but also countries that are related to climate change, for instance. So if a country like Holland, which is way back compared to other European member states in terms of the environment and climate change and greenhouse gases, we have a AAA rating. But I think we can soon say goodbye to that AAA rating once we conclude, or Standard & Poor's concludes, that actually we're not addressing climate change at all, which is a risk for the ability of this country to be financially successful in the future. The Financial Stability Board, the big watchdog of financial markets, is also embarking on this. So all for risk mitigation reasons. They call it the RAROC, the risk-adjusted returns on capital, which are revisiting. So again, not for ethical and moral reasons probably, but mostly because of risk mitigation reasons. The financial sector is looking into sustainability, and not just climate change and environment-related issues, but also health-related issues and social issues. So things are definitely changing. Mm-hmm. So the publicity we got with this true cost accounting pilot is actually something we didn't quite deserve. I think we hit a nerve in the zeitgeist or the spirit of time that seems to be ready, with or without your president. Global organizations and business, and particularly the institutional investors, are increasingly looking into this just to make sure that you blend in long-term criteria to assess whether you can be profitable in future or not.
Yeah, and I mean, at $4 trillion, this has to be listened to, and whether it's risk mitigation for large financial institutions that are doing it because they are required to, well, however we get there, right? It's, and to be honest, that's probably the best pragmatic approach we got to appealing to folks like our current president, who will cut off his nose to spite his face, it seems. So, yeah, a bit of a challenge when describing this, that this is a cost basis for future circular economies, which is the only economy type that we have moving forward. But right. I think the challenge becomes when people are not as aware or immersed into these concepts, and they think that we do not live within a finite planetary boundaries or resources, then challenges come about. The kind of old school mentality of what imprint can we actually have? So, you know, I think those are the challenges we fight here stateside. And it's great to hear using that example of financial models to actually develop that. And Volker, I want to jump into that because I think it's key for our listeners to talk a little or to understand a little bit more of this wasn't just in some crazy vacuum. You actually launched an initiative, a framework to help develop and create some validity behind this, some integrity behind that. And you used your new initiative that you launched called Nature and More, which is a transparency and traceability framework, which uses a balanced scorecard to assess what consumers do care about for their, you call it your sustainability flower. And from what I read, it said the sustainable flower is a model to evaluate, manage, and communicate sustainability achievements of organic growers. The six flower petal deal with ecology, soil, water, air, plants, animal, and energy. And the heart of the flower shows the words freedom, justice, and solidarity, which refer to cultural, societal, and economic sustainability, respectively. And I think that's a key thing because we need these frameworks, this infrastructure, the wireframes to build many of these true cost accounting around. Because if we didn't have integrity, then why we can have a direct correlation of where you spend your money and the values it does for all of those six elements within your flower petals, boy, it would just be a lot of fluff. It'd be a bit of some of the mistakes we've made in the past with the greenwashing or using sustainability in out of context or using it as only a marketing term without the authenticity. So, and you've had that program out way before many of the initiatives we've seen stateside or really around the world launching this idea of traceability and transparency and what's even developed into the idea of a blockchain. So could you share a bit more with our audience how that came about and then how this has developed into a framework to allow you to really expedite those conversations to maybe reap the benefit of true cost accounting where others couldn't because they didn't have that framework?
Right. Yeah. Thanks for asking, Aaron. These things are never, this is never something you can do on your own. So what we believe in this 3D leadership model that starts, we call it dream, dance, deliver. So if you want to deliver change, you need to dance, you need to co-create with others. But in order to co-create, you select a coalition of the willing that shares the same dream. Because change has never come from a following majority. It has always come and will always be coming from a trendsetting minority. So that's precisely the audience we are targeting with that Nature More sustainability flower. We are not talking to the followers, the consumers who actually don't care about their health and the environment. That sounds a little bit arrogant, but we're not talking to about an economic elite. We're talking to an awareness elite, both on the supply side as well as on the consumer side, but also on the stakeholder side. So we teamed up with all those folks to establish this Nature More Sustainability flower as a dashboard to, again, apply the four M's to measure the impact on human health, on the environment, on society, to manage incremental steps of development, to market the impact, positive impact, and finally to monetize that impact so we could provide the financial sector and our shareholders and our stakeholders to look at our profitability from a whole new perspective, a perspective that does not only look at financial capital but also ecological or natural and social capital. But again, we teamed up with suppliers, with retailers, with consumers, with NGOs, with many think tanks to come to look for a dashboard that would unite the performance indicators that would be available in the market. And this is not something, it's not a static thing. So we keep adding and canceling performance indicators, which is basically the footprint of a continuous dialogue with our stakeholders. And that has led to a dashboard, a nature more sustainability flower, that is used by consumers. And if you ask how many, well, I think it's only a few percent of our consumers. But that doesn't matter for us. The fact that people can is already enough. That provides trustworthiness, and then is usually the so-called professional consumers who are engaged in other sustainability projects who keep checking this and keep us on our toes to be correct and precise and about it. But retailers also, you know, they have all these environmental and social compliance schemes that you must meet as a license to operate, to serve them, before. So your growers are again burdened with that enormous load of assessments on an environmental and social level. And you have BSCI, Business Social Compliance International. The English have ETI, the Ethical Trading Initiative. You have the Organic Scheme, the Fair Trade Scheme. And what we eventually developed was one platform that unites all these schemes. So the big benefit for our growers is they only need one assessment to serve all these schemes. So that is where the dance comes in. You need to dance with all the partners in your supply chain, in your sector, to achieve maximum convergence and to make things simple without risking to make them superficial, or without risking to greenwash things. So it's third-party audited, and it serves as a framework for growers to manage incremental steps of development. It enables consumers to make a more informed purchase decision, but it also serves as a dashboard for monetization. And in the meantime, we've developed this to the next level, this pilot, this true cost accounting pilot, by also engaging with ministries in Dutch government who are looking at this famous question: how can we create a more level playing field in the market where the polluter pays and the one who contributes to sustainability is rewarded by applying fiscal instruments? So I'm not saying, so some people ask, what do you think, Volker? Should we wait for government? Should we wait for the sleeping giant called the consumer? Should we wait for the grower? Should we wait for the? Should we work with the sustainability movement? Should we talk to the EYs and the financial sector? And my stereotype reply is always, well, that depends on your karma. But theoretically, you should talk to everybody, and find out where your unique coalition is, where you can. Where you have a sort of connection with some of these parties that can be fruitful in order to deliver change. And so what you actually do is you widen your circle of influence, because sort of being hijacked by a circle of concern never helps. So widening your circle of influence is something that is very rewarding. And if you look at our company, you know, we usually call ourselves the simple greengrocer from Waddinxveen West in West Holland. But the impact we have on this whole sustainability discussion and on new policies that address a more level playing field, fiscal solutions to address that more level playing field, helping our economy to be less autistic, including costs of damage to human health or to the environment, is working. And that explains, I think, why we're having this success, which really, honestly, is not our achievement, is purely the achievement of a co-creation with various parties that met at the right time.
Well, it's fascinating, Volkert, because obviously taking that model, and maybe it's foresight, to be honest, because maybe that's where you should absolutely take the credit, because when you talk to everyone, you can do many things with that. But what you've seemed to have created is defining a common language under a central tent and building out a multi-stakeholder initiative. And these MSIs have become more broadly used, even at the UN or across the board, in solving complex issues. We have many different diverse stakeholders or shareholders who have interest in solving and addressing these big problems or getting to the same goal, but often they go nowhere because there'll be a lot of discussion with really no solutions. Overlaying this with your solutions, your company, and then really a next iteration, which I think is again, quite impressive. Earlier you had mentioned that we're losing 30 football fields of soil every minute around the world for irresponsible farming practice. And
right.
Through that, you launched an initiative called Save Our Soils, which you have these conferences, you have ambassadors around the world that are fighting for awareness and understanding of how important soil is for climate mitigation, for feeding ourselves, for the sponge of the earth and water management, all of these reasons and rationale that I think people just don't even look for what's underfoot of being the saving grace. But boy, it really is. You've developed these initiatives to engage in this. And it's just for audience perspective, mm-hmm. just so they get an idea of what folks may not know is it takes 500 years to produce 1 inch of good topsoil. 500
right.
years. And we're
right.
depleting it at 30 football fields per minute around the globe. So we got some problems here. And we're basically, as you mentioned, we're polluting our horizon. We're capitalizing on our kids' succession plan. We're doing all of these things for short-term revenue gain. And it's really just without having any kind of context or architecture. So it's taking a step back and looking at those MSIs, those multi-stakeholder initiative. You were able to launch this Save Our Soils, which I think you had a big conference a couple of years ago in Amsterdam.
That 2015, was, yeah.
2015, okay. So trying to really bring some of these discussions. And then you use this as a mechanism to brief the UN on soil health. Can you tell us a bit about what you told them and what you learned from this process around Save Our Soils?
Yeah, well... Again, I don't know. A lot of people are looking at us, but really the honor should go to the FAO in Rome, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, who declared 2015 as the year of the soil, because they knew, they realized climate change is on the agenda, water pollution is on the agenda, biodiversity is on the agenda. A lot of these environmental issues are on the agenda. But soil isn't. People are talking about substrates or vertical farming, and we have shitloads of mineral fertilizers. So what to worry about when it comes to soil? And then they said, well, we have a little issue here. Yeah, you can do vertical farming, you can do substrate, and you can use mineral fertilizer. But if you want to feed the world, then... it is an illusion to think that you can intensify farming further. You actually need to take a step back and be more extensive and include crop rotation, compost, biodiversity, cover crops, all of this. If you want to sustain the ability to feed the world the day after tomorrow, if you want to feed today's world, it's perfectly okay to exploit the shit out of these soils and not worry about depletion long term. But if you want to feed the world tomorrow, then it makes sense to rather take a, step back and sacrifice a little bit of production productivity or yield, but increase the ability of these soils to be fertile and productive tomorrow. Another thing that comes in is that FAO concluded is that we need what they call climate smart agriculture, but we also need water smart agriculture. Well, that all, Aaron, starts with a proper soil, with soil fertility. Because if you increase the soil organic matter content, if you increase the diversity in your soil, if you increase the microbial activity in your soil, then you automatically increase the water holding capacity of that soil. You automatically contribute to biodiversity, which is soil in a biodiverse, which is born in a biodiverse soil. And you also sequester CO2 from the atmosphere in that soil. So it seems to be a powerful portal for a whole series of other sustainability issues. So that's why we launched this campaign together with the United Nations, but with 200 more NGOs and a lot of VIPs. You mentioned a few. Because we said, okay, let's conclude that not the sky is the limit, but the soil is the limit. And organic may not be the only solution, but for the time being, is by far the best solution. And you, dear customer, you can become a soldier by digging up a few pavement stones and use our products, because all our products carry a little bit of compost and a few seeds. That's what we did throughout the year. I think you've seen these examples, haven't you? The so-called soil mates. We would sort of sell 500 gram tomatoes and add a little bit of compost and basil seeds. And we would invite consumers to become a soldier by digging up a pavement stone, start a little guerrilla farm, and YouTube this, ideally whilst the police was trying to stop them, and because you know that a little bit of disruption usually is good for communication.
Absolutely.
And then a lot of people did this, particularly, you know, including famous politicians and other VIPs. So that triggered an enormous echo, because people realized that again, if we want to feed tomorrow's planet, then actually organic is quite an interesting solution, because you know in the background you had this discussion, organic is more extensive, so can it feed the world? How many planets do we need? We only have one planet, so we should actually intensify. But if you look deeper, the opposite emerges as the reality. So this was enormously successful, I think, for the reason, and again, it was a co-creation and multi-stakeholder, the result of a multi-stakeholder dialogue and cooperation with many institutions, UN-based scientists, politicians, VIPs. And we were just very pragmatic about it, by selling millions of these packages, millions of our products, as soil made. So we reached out to millions of consumers who actually liked it very much. And by the way, the Soil Deer, are you still with me?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the Soil Deer campaign. So was quite funny, because we said organic friends of ours farm in Egypt, and they convert, this time they've converted 30,000 hectares of Sahara desert soil into fertile agricultural soil, dark black agricultural soil, with the help of organic farming techniques. And so we said to the consumers, if you win the prize, because your YouTube is most disruptive and excels in creativity, and you can win a prize to go to Egypt. And we said a few hundred consumers can win this. But then we had that Arab Spring just happening in Egypt. Mm-hmm. So then for fun, we changed it into Syria. So people were very upset about this. Yeah, but Syria is also very is also a problem. Anyway, so it's just the whole campaign was a lot of fun and a lot of disruption.
Yeah.
And a lot of humor, and we deliberately decided to take this Robin Food approach because we thought it's way too serious to be serious about it.
I love it. It's a great approach. It takes the edge off, right? Gets people talking, and again, it all reverts back to the fact that we're all eaters, and we can right. take a steak here, and we are burning through our cash, but and doing it instead of investing in our cost basis of future long term economies, but you know, that future fiduciary model of investing in better organic food seems to be resonating with more. So I think that's exciting and evolution. I do like your approach of being a rabble rouser and having some civil disobedience from people that you may not expect to do that. And I think that creates some enthusiasm and excitement, maybe even a little viral element within the internet, right? Of getting uncommon bedfellow folks to have conversations about soil or growing or food or agriculture.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, you mentioned this earlier, that this sustainability challenge is very complex. And so we decided on a two-track approach. On the one side, you need the sustainability flower to bring a structure into this complexity and include the Sustainable Development Goals by United Nations, and you know, make sure that you're complete. And that the other track is simplify everything. I mean, in your communications, don't talk about everything, just talk about soil, or the bees, or so ideally you try to hit a button that that seems to be hanging over the market. You just need to spot it. And if you then team up with the right people at the right moment, you can have an impact. And we did a bee campaign. We did a biodiversity campaign. The biodiversity campaign was less successful. We're doing a health campaign now, because as a result of this true cost accounting exercise, we concluded that organic apples, just to give one example, 14 cents per kilo healthy, actually 21 cents per kilo healthier than conventional apples because of pesticide pressure on the conventional apples. And so people often say, well, you know, there's an equal number of studies that prove that organic is healthier, as there is a number of studies that proves that you can't prove that. And so be careful what you say. You can't just say organic is healthier. So I loved the idea that we would go public with this claim in the shelf that organic apples are healthier. And if they would have a problem, if anybody would have a problem with that, they would have to call the WHO, the World Health Organization, whose templates we used to establish that reality. And then we had Ernst & Young, EY, validate this. So we said, listen, these guys don't just only specialize in Panama Papers and tax avoiding schemes, but they're actually quite accurate when it comes to validating this claim. So don't shoot the messenger. And this was a great success. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with the DALI calculation that is used by the WHO.
I'm not. No, if you could share, that'd be great.
Well, it's quite complicated, but the core of the matter is that the DALI stands for disability adjusted life years. So if you assume that agrochemicals are used to, you know, they're toxic, So that's why you have MRLs on your product. And retailers need to make sure that, that the pesticide pressure on a product stays below that threshold. But it doesn't mean that it's not toxic. So what we did was we took all data from EFSA on pesticide occurrences on product and put that through this DALI calculation, through this disability adjusted life year calculation, because it reduces, they have a calculation to establish world health statuses, to measure the impact on human health, and they express that in numbers, in a monetized way. So if your life expectancy is reduced as a result of illness or pesticides caused illnesses, then that costs society an X amount of dollars or euros. So we that's the calculation we used. We used EFSA data and had EY analyze this. And then they came to the simple conclusion that organic apples are 20 cents per kilo healthier than conventional apples.
Well,
so we used... I just wanted to mention this. We thought this is great fun. So we also started selling turmeric. Are you familiar with turmeric?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ginger type of... with a lot of health benefits. So we decided to sell these as medicine, as pills, also in pill boxes and blister packs. And then we had little leaflets inside that warn you for the side effects, that you can get yellow fingers and all of that. And we started to take the piss out of the pharmaceutical industry that's actually parasitizing on our health by selling you a pill. And if you use that, you have a few side effects, but they have pills for that too. So it's a very sustainable business model, except that it is parasiting on your health, like agrochemicals are parasiting on this planet's health.
That's right.
And so we said we had big campaigns in Dutch retailers asking consumers, are you also suffering from big pharma? So maybe you should check out your greengrocer. And we listed also a whole series of symptoms of big pharma. You know, mental itching was one of them. so it was raising a big middle finger toward big pharma until we got some of their lawyers on our necks and had to fall back on these calculations that actually turmeric is way more healthy than conventional and certainly healthier than pills.
Yeah.
So we won all these court cases, and that triggered nice momentum.
Yeah.
Amongst consumers who always intuitively realized that health doesn't come from pills, but from healthy food.
Yeah.
And ideally organic food.
Absolutely. Well, I like the tongue-in-cheek approach. And what I think is interesting is as the U.S. has awoken to the idea of fake news and the influence it has in our politics, we've been living with fake news in the food systems and agriculture for years. All of those reports you're saying that are counter to the WHO's reports, you got to ask the question of who's paying for those, right? Who's going head-to-head with the organic model? It's people that can benefit from usually a biopharma or agrochemical company. So, and that's, you know, that gets lost in the mainstream discussion. So it's wonderful. And I think taking it with a bit of a fun approach to it is a great way to do it. So Volker, where can our listeners learn more about EOSTA, about nature and more, and about if there are going to be a future Save Our Soils campaigns, or where they can get more information about the 2015 gathering?
I think the saveoursoils.com site is still active, although we're not pursuing it right now because we're engaged in other campaigns. But it's still active, and most of the information can be found at eosta.com or natureandmore.com.
And we can also find more information about some of the more recent developments with the true cost accounting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
On the Nature More, as well as on the EOSTA site.
Fantastic. So, well, let's just say that let's eat more fruit and veg, preferably one that retains a sustainable flower attached, because we want our good friend Volker Dinkelsmann to reap the benefit for the great work he's been doing. And let's find a way to be part of the solution through the food we choose to eat. And I think that's a key thing for all of us, no matter where we are on this shrinking planet, to be part of the solution. And that silver bullet seems to be through the food we select. So, Volker Dinkelsmann, I can't thank you enough for joining us on Sourcing Matters today. I learned a lot, and I know our listeners will as well.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for the opportunity, Aaron.
Wonderful. Speak to you soon. Thank you, Volker.
All right. Bye-bye.